This is a HeadGum Podcast.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Why, hello, my friends. It is again Michael Cruz Kane, back with another episode of A Good Cry, this time with the author Amy Bloom. Amy is a novelist, a short storyist, not a word, and most notably for us, a memoirist who has written a memoir entitled In Love, which you must read legally, it is legally required, about her marriage to her husband Brian, his Alzheimer's diagnosis, and eventually his decision to end his life, which he did with the aid of an assisted death organization in Switzerland called Dignitas. We talk about navigating the hurdles that come with trying to achieve a dignified death. We also talk about, among other things, the desire for at least some of your work to feel useful, which, as someone who is constantly trying to process his own grief through the lens of how can it be helpful to other people and selfishly to myself, I found educational, edifying, and I'm going to have to give most of the credit for that to Amy, who has a way with language that can only be described as expert. I would take issue with one thing she said, which is that fiction is of no use to anybody. And I know that's not true because I've read Amy's fiction. In addition to In Love, there's also several books. Just one that I read recently is A Blind Man Can See How Much I Love You, which is a collection of short stories that will convince you of the usefulness of writing. It was, I think, Auden who said, poetry makes nothing happen. And I gotta tell you, I think he was wrong. Reading Auden or Amy Bloom, you cannot help but know that every kind of writing in the hands of a great author can be so, so useful. This is A Good Cry with Amy Bloom. Thanks for listening. Okay, great. So this is the podcast now. Thank you so much for doing it. The way that we start the podcast is with a little bit of an open-ended question that is, Amy, how would you describe your relationship to grief at the moment?
Well, I don't know that my relationship to grief is very different than anybody else's. It is more clear to me now, probably, than it was when I was younger, that grief is absolutely the price you pay for love. And I suppose in some ways, having recognized that, you know, it's sort of like, oh, I recognize that. That's the color blue. And so whenever I see blue, I know what it is. And sort of like grief is something, it seems to me, the impulse is to avoid it. And I certainly appreciate that. On the other hand, it is something, it seems to me, that you live with. And it is not your only life, but it certainly comes with you.
When you talk about avoidance, is that something that you yourself, like, it sounds like what you're talking about is like a transition from an instinct to avoid it to sort of like an inevitability of, I don't know if acceptance is the right word, but like experiencing it. Is that something that you...
Well, you better accept it, you know. It's like, it's not optional. It's not like air conditioning, you know. If you have relationships, you will have grief. You will have joy and you will have grief. You will have beauty and you will have loss. It's like, seems to me that that's sort of the package. And so the effort to avoid grief, which doesn't mean that you should do stupid things or put yourself in harm's way, but to not love somebody you love because it might go badly or because there are obstacles or because there's a lack of perfection seems to me to be a little bit of a misunderstanding of what the deal is.
Yeah. In your most recent book and in your life, you write a lot about Brian and going to end his life. Assisted suicide, is that the terminology?
Yeah. I mean, in Switzerland, they call it accompanied suicide or accompanied dying. But yeah.
Is that like the closeness between the two of you? Is that loss the most significant encounter that you've had in your life with grief? Like, I know, like, for me, I have a son who died. Prior to that, I'd had family members die and, like, friends who had died very young or whatever. And all of them had sort of washed over me in a way. Like, it sort of felt like, even though that happened in my immediate circle, it felt like it was happening kind of to someone else. The death of my son was the first time that I was like, oh, this is happening to me now. I wonder if the loss of Brian is similar to you or not.
Well, I mean, that loss is certainly the greatest and the deepest loss. On the other hand, I sat with both of my parents at their deathbeds and also two of my closest friends in the world also sat with them at their deathbeds. So I suppose I might have more than the average person experience with this, but, you know, there is never any point in comparing losses. You know, right. Brian's is the deepest and the greatest, but, you know, is always the rest of life, you know.
Right. Did those other losses prepare you in any way? Like, did you find them to be useful as they kept on?
I think they only prepared me in the smallest of ways. I mean, they prepared me, one, for the fact that people often mean well and do badly. And that mm-hmm. if you focus on that, you will spend a tremendous amount of time being enraged pointlessly. So that was useful. And also, I think being able to sit with it. You know, I didn't have to make myself useful. I mean, sometimes, you know, you want to wash the dishes and fold the laundry, and sometimes you want to sit there and just be deeply in a pool of grief. And I think that maybe those earlier experiences prepared me for the fact that you never know how it's going to hit you, whether you're going to wake up and that is the morning in which you fold everybody's clothes and drive them to the Goodwill, or that is the morning where you refuse to leave your bed. And that those are both appropriate and necessary responses, and there's no need to fight either one of them.
Yeah, I think that's such a great way of putting that sort of, like, I mean, I think for me, there's also those moments where you're like, I can't believe there is such a thing as laundry. You know what I mean? Like that,
right?
The surreality of everything, especially in the immediate aftermath,
yes,
is very relatable. And it does feel like maybe you don't really know when you wake up if it's going to be a day that you're capable of anything other than sitting
right.
with it. What has the process been like for you in terms of how you have felt about the loss and grief? He died, I mean, not very long ago.
2.5 years ago.
So has the way in which you think about that loss changed since then?
Well, I don't know that I think about the loss very much, but the way I feel about it sort of ebbs and flows. You know, there are days when I send my mother-in-law, Brian's mother, a photo of the tree I planted in my yard, which has a plaque and his name, and, you know, and I put a bunch of flowers around it and I send her the photo. There are those kinds of days. And there are days where somebody asks me something about Brian and it is all I can do not to burst into tears, which is not because I think you shouldn't burst into tears, but sometimes in the middle of a conversation, you don't always want to. And then there are days where I just think of him with, you know, great love and great warmth and appreciate him. And then that's that. That's that for the day. So it varies so much, which is why I feel like there's not that much value in sort of fighting to regulate it or box it up or contain it or even necessarily explain it.
Yeah. Do you find that the times when you feel like you might burst into tears are less frequent, or is it like as time goes on?
Yeah. Well, yeah, because I was sort of awash for the first 6 months, just awash. And now, I mean, there are certain things that will always make me burst into tears, but I can also evoke him and talk about him in ways that are not mostly tearful, that still have all the sadness, but there's also just more room for love and appreciation.
Just to talk about some parts of your book that I really stuck with me, you use the phrase a blanket of indifference, where I guess I should let you describe what that means. But to me, it was this idea of like, I don't really want to feel, to me, it was relatable to me because there are times when I didn't want to feel like I had to perform any kind of response to anything. And so the easiest thing was for no one to give me anything, and then I don't have to give you anything back. Can you talk more about that?
Well, yeah. I mean, I was just aware that there were moments, and there were lots of moments, where I didn't want to be on the receiving end of anybody else's feelings, however kind, however generous, or however whatever they were. I was just like, you keep it to yourself, and I will keep me to myself. And let's leave it at that. You know, how about that? You know, and a real wish for indifference, a wish to be sort of left alone emotionally, not to be touched. I mean, not to be touched emotionally or physically, just left alone. That's not always easy to arrange.
Yeah. I mean, that part of it, I know a lot of people who listen to this and myself, like that's very, that sense of like, someone asks me about my kids and I have to tell them that, you know, something horrible happened. And the impact that it has on them is so severe that now it's like, oh, I have to take care of you now, I think, because this thing that happened to me.
Yeah, there actually were a couple of times before the book came out where honestly somebody would say, "Oh, how are things?" I'd be like, "Good." You know, but I cannot bring myself to share this with you and then have your grieving, sympathetic, horrified, oh, there but for the grace of God, let me tell you about my father and his Alzheimer's response. Because I thought, oh, you know, so we're both better off if I don't tell you, because you're going to tell me and I'm going to want to kill you. And also, you're going to feel terrible. So why don't we just not do that?
Yeah, as an act of mercy, I'm going to lie to you in this moment.
Right. Or I'm going to pretend I can't hear you. Maybe I had a tiny stroke. I mean, who thinks, okay, my somebody doesn't answer your question.
The way you answer that question makes me think of the way in which you write, the way in which you report the conversations that you've had with Brian. There's a lot of humor in that. I was struck by the ordering shrimp at the Palm and him being like, you know, if I die of food poisoning, basically that's it would save everybody a lot of energy effectively.
Right.
A lot of people, I think, who haven't experienced something like this would be surprised to find that there was ever laughter during it and in its aftermath. So if you could talk a little bit about that, I think that'd be illuminating.
I feel like my two early encounters with humor in dark times was I worked in an emergency room. I was trained as a clinical social worker, so I worked in the ER. So if you want to see humor in dark times, you just go to a big city ER 3 o'clock on Saturday morning. It is hilarious. So there's that. My dear friend, who was also my high school English teacher and really a father figure for me, when he was dying, I was driving down from Connecticut to Long Island on a regular basis. And he had another best friend. I'm sure his other best friend didn't appreciate that I was the other best friend any more than I appreciated him. He was an old, fussy, grumpy European guy. And I would come in and Malcolm, my friend, would be lying in the hospital bed and, you know, so slipping away. And his friend would have been playing Wagner. Or I'm like, blah, you know. And so then I would say, not very subtly, oh, grumpy European gentleman. Why don't you go get yourself a nice cup of coffee from the cafeteria? And he would go to the cafeteria and I would switch over the music to the music that I used to listen to with my friend, which would be more Helen Humes or Billie Holiday or Oscar Peterson, would be more jazz. And then, of course, he would come back and he would say to me very clearly, oh, little lady, perhaps it's your turn for coffee. So that was pretty funny. And then with Brian, I mean, Brian had a good sense of humor. You know, I would say less so, understandably, as he was grappling with Alzheimer's. For some people, I think that that sense of humor does not really fade. But I think for other people, if the components of your sense of humor are also irony and nuance, it's going to alter as you progress through dementia. But there were just things that were funny. We had somebody close, this is a funny story, offer to accompany us to Zurich. And then that person realized that they really didn't want to. And the person was on speakerphone and basically suggested that because it was going to be so upsetting to come back from Zurich without Brian, and I was like, oh, yeah, me too. I agree. The person suggested that they bring their spouse, at which point Brian indicated to me, like with his finger across his throat, hang up the phone. So I said, oh, thanks so much. Hang up the phone. And Brian says to me, it's going to be the last 4 days of my fucking life. You know who I'm not spending it with? That person. So, you know.
That's very funny.
I know.
Your writing about this, you talk about Brian wanting you to write about it.
Very much.
And your initial response, I think, was something like, oh, honey, which indicated, I think, that maybe you thought it wasn't appropriate to write about it first. Or did you have some hesitancy?
Didn't want to. I mean, it wasn't, I didn't think it was a bad idea necessarily, but I didn't want to. I'm not a memoir writer. I'm not even a memoir reader. You know, this is not my genre. I'm like, I don't know. And as he said to me, he said two things. One, he said, I think it's important. And he said, you're a writer. He said, I'm not going to go out and find a writer. You're a writer. I was like, oh.
Did the process of writing it, how did that feel to write about Brian?
It was certainly not like writing a novel. I certainly wrote it much more quickly than I usually do my fiction. I'm quite a pokey writer. You know, there were parts where I could just tell the story. This happened, then this happened. And then times when I was thinking about it and experiencing it anew and just crying and typing. You know, what it was not for me, although lots of people have asked, was cathartic. And I think that's probably because I'm a writer. So it's, you know, it's a job. It's a craft. You know, it's like being a plumber or maybe being a, I don't know what else it is like, but it's a job. And so when I finished writing, I didn't feel like, oh, that's done. Now I can let go of my fear. I mean, I don't know how that works. You know, when it was done, I thought, oh, thank God. I can turn it into my editor and listen to her helpful remarks, that none of which I wanted to take. That was actually probably the biggest difference, I think, between writing fiction and writing the memoir, which is that when I'm writing fiction and my editor makes suggestions, which are invariably intelligent and useful, I just take them. I go, great, great, great. Thanks so much. Here's the rewrite. And this one, she would say things that were entirely correct. Like, I think you need more about how Brian's symptoms developed and how you noticed them. And I've been working with this woman for 20 years. And I was like, nope, I think we're good. And she'd be like, no. I really think that would be useful. And I'm like, no, I think you've misunderstood. And she'd be like, no, I really think you'd. And finally, I was like, fine. And of course, I didn't want to write about it because it is in some ways, you know, the great grief for me is that Brian got Alzheimer's. It is terrible to have had to leave him and lose him. so early in his life, in our life. But the real grief is the disease and how that was just peeling away at his self and his life. And so having to write about the symptoms was just, I just did not want to. I just wanted to think about him as he had been before the illness and think about his bravery in the process of ending his life and not dwell on the other parts. So it was never cathartic, but I think it was probably important.
Yeah, I mean, I understand the job aspect of it as a comedian similarly, when people are like, right. Oh, then do some jokes. And it's like, no, that's my professional life over right. there. That's a different part of me. In writing the book, I know I can think of many purposes that it serves for people who read it, right? Like many ways in which it would help them, or, you know, even if they can't relate intimately to the experience, it's just brilliant writing. So it's like, it's entertaining to read in that way. But for you, is there a purpose? Like, do you have a goal when you sit down to write something like this?
Well, I hope I never write anything like this again. But this book, yeah, my purpose was to be useful. My purpose was to tell people things that maybe they didn't know, to encourage them to think about things that maybe they hadn't thought about, to encourage families to talk more about things that people don't talk about. And that was really Brian's wish, and it was my wish with the book. And that's the entire, I mean, you know, I think it's a good book, but I think the goal of it was really just to be useful if I could be.
And is that different from, do you feel that way when you're writing other stuff?
No, I don't. No, fiction is of no use to anybody. It's like, if people are engaged with the story and it matters to them, I am delighted. Often in interviews about a novel of mine, somebody will say, well, what do you want people to take away? And it's like, I don't care. And it was like, they should take away whatever they want, or nothing. Or it was like a pleasant few days, or it was a gripping few days, or they learned a lot more about the Yiddish theater than they had known before. And it's like, whatever it is for them, I'm glad. But my purpose is to tell the story that I have come up with the best way I know how and the most engaging way. And then it is what it is for the reader. That's really sort of the reader's call. It's not my, I don't have a destination that I need to drive them to. With the memoir, I really did want to be useful. I wanted to be clear. I wanted to be honest. And I wanted to be as helpful as I could be to people in a wide range of circumstances, whether it's just older people who are married or people who are facing various illnesses or people who are facing illnesses themselves, and just try to be straightforward and helpful if I could be.
Is that something that you had wanted, like in your career, has being useful been something you had aspired to? Like, and this happened, it's like, oh, I can be of use. Or did this happen? And do you understand what I'm asking? I'm saying it very clumsily.
I try to be a decent human being, but I don't know that being of use is, I mean, I guess being of use is a priority for me. You know, I have a lot of children. I have a lot of grandchildren. I do good deeds. So it's not of no interest to me. But with this book, my first thought was, Brian wanted me to tell the story because he thought it would be helpful to people. So I told the story. And then as I was editing and refining it, it did occur to me that, oh, this actually might be helpful to people. And that was good. And certainly the email and responses that I've gotten make me feel like, oh, this has been helpful to people.
Do you respond to the people who, there must be tons of people messaging you?
I do respond to a lot. I don't respond to all. And sometimes people have a wish for much more specific and detailed guidance, like, please walk me through the process of applying to Dignitas. And my own feeling is it's pretty clear in the book. It's also pretty clear on Dignitas's website. And, you know, I usually feel like, There's probably somebody else in your life whom you actually know who could do this with you.
Right.
And sometimes it's just too much for me. And I decline with as much kindness as I can. And lots of emails I do respond to.
Yeah, I have the similar, you haven't even expressed this. I'm now projecting my feelings onto you. But I do, I try to respond to everything. But I know now that this has come up, I'm going to be haunted by the ghosts of the emails that I have yet to respond to.
Yeah.
Because people have profound experiences and I have finite time, even though, well, anyway. I'll talk to my therapist about this later. The reason I'm just to go back a step, the reason I was asking about usefulness is that that idea is fascinating to me. In my own work as a comedian, it's like, you know, you reach a point, I would imagine you've reached as an author where it's like, okay, I'm good at this now. Like, you know, there may have been a time, maybe there wasn't. I mean, maybe you just knew how great you were at writing.
Sure. But 100%.
So for there's a period of time where I'm like struggling to make sure that to convince myself and other people that I'm funny. But then once I reach that, it is odd to be like, okay, well now what? And then the idea of usefulness has like occupies a much bigger role in my own work of like, you know, anything, every joke I tell, what's the point of this joke? Because I know how to do funny jokes now.
Right.
Now, what will I do with it? What am I going to make you laugh at?
No, I agree with that. I mean, to me, certainly the second half of your life, the first half of your life, you're busy running around doing a lot of other things. But the second half, you know, it's about joy and purpose. And you want to have both those things. However it is that that shapes up for you. And, you know, I just sometimes one doesn't want to be useful. It's just like I think that there's a human need to be stupid sometimes. I was looking at my phone the other day. I was having trouble reading something on my phone. My reading glasses were literally a foot and a half away from me. And I'm observing myself sitting in my armchair, squinting at the phone, sort of cursing my fate. You know, because I just wanted to be stupid and not get the reading glasses until finally I just sort of said to myself, Amy, okay, now you've been stupid. So now you can pull yourself together and get your goddamn reading glasses and read the thing that you're reading. But I think there is a human wish sometimes to be sort of lazy and stupid. And you got to account for that sometimes. And I think if you're lucky, there's a wish to be useful and then you can do it. It is not... It's not aspirational, you know? I mean, I'd also like to be like a prima ballerina, but that's not going to happen. On the other hand, I can be useful.
Right. Listen, I believe with enough dedication, you still have a shot at the ballet.
No, I appreciate that. Yeah, no, I see it the way you see it.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about all from the comfort of your home isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's Byte.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
In terms of accompanied suicide, right? That's mm-hmm. the phrase.
Yeah, and that's just their phrase that they use, but it's all what we mean by assisted suicide. Or aid in dying, which is what they call it in Canada, which is actually, I think, more accurate because there is nothing about how we conventionally think about suicide that's really appropriate for these sort of circumstances. So in Canada, as I say, they call it aid in dying.
Even the way you talk about the vernacular, have you become something of like an expert in, I mean, maybe not worldwide, but relative to a typical American?
Sure.
You probably have a level of expertise about how people deal with death worldwide.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know that it's expertise, but I certainly have done a lot of listening and I've certainly done a lot of research.
Can you talk a little bit about the difference between the attitudes you encountered at Dignitas versus trying to accomplish a similar thing here in the States?
Well, I mean, Dignitas is, as I keep saying, they're Swiss. You know, they're organized, they're disciplined, they're clean, they're tidy, they're careful. You know, they're decent people. There's not much to compare it to. I mean, we don't have that service in the United States. We don't have that option. And legally, when you look at the 10 right to die states, these are incredibly tiny needles with very, very small openings that people are asked to thread. And it becomes clear as you look through the laws that the purpose of these laws is not to offer humane care to people at the end of their life. It's to keep people from taking advantage of the service. Because you have to have a terminal illness. You have to have two doctors to declare that you have a terminal illness. And they have to declare that you have no more than 6 months left to live. Now, many, many people who are terminally ill and in the last 6 months of their life are not really capable of fully engaging in a somewhat lengthy process of becoming a resident, getting two doctors to sign off on this, writing an essay, having two oral interviews, then waiting 2 weeks, then picking up the prescription, and then self-administering a lethal dose. So if you think about people you know in this world who are in the last 6 months of a terminal illness, many of those people are not capable of doing that. Not because it isn't their wish, but they cannot do it unaided. If you have a dementing disease, none of these are of any use to you at all. Because although Alzheimer's, for example, is a terminal illness, it is a terminal illness you could have for 10 years. And if you are in the last 6 months of it, you have no cognitive function. So how would you possibly take advantage of this? I don't think anything that I'm saying did not occur to the various state governing bodies of those various states. The decision was make this as narrow as possible. So as few people as possible will make use of these laws in our state. And they have succeeded.
Yeah, and there's probably some cases in which making it difficult is good. I guess it's just maybe a marker of how, you know, like insurance companies and litigiousness and et cetera have degraded the quality, I was going to say quality of life, but like quality of death, really.
Yes, and some of that is about insurance, but a great deal of that is actually about the religious convictions of
people. Oh, really?
I guess that makes sense. Strongly that people should not be allowed to make these choices, period.
Yeah, I have one of my dad's close friends died in Maine very recently, and it was through one of these processes. He had cancer, and so I think he was able, I don't know how to say it without sounding crass, but he was able to like clear a bunch of the hurdles
100%.
That you're talking about.
I'm so glad. For him that he was able to.
And we had a guest on the podcast in season one, James Naughton, who was advocating for laws that were, you know, enable people to die with dignity in other states around the country. But I'm aware, though not intimately, with how difficult it can be to sort of die on your own terms in this country.
Very.
One of the things you talked about is, after he had taken the sodium pentobarbital, I wrote this down because it shattered me a little bit. You said, "I get up and wrap my arms around him and kiss his forehead as if he is my baby, at last gone to sleep, as if he is my brave boy going on a long journey, miles and miles of naught." That feels so identical to my son dying. Like that, the moment of holding him and saying effectively, like, you go on ahead, which even like in trying to remember it, I don't even remember if I said it. I just know that it was said. It was either me or my wife. One of us said that. And it was so odd to connect that loss to your loss insofar as the person I was talking to was barely a month old. And the person that you were talking to is a fully accomplished, a man who has lived, I guess, maybe not, I don't know, would a full life. I don't know if full is the right word to use.
I think
there,
it was a
man
full
who has,
life. I think
who's
it was
lived
a full
lot
life.
Of a life.
He was a big life embracer, but I imagine that the part of the way in which you recognize my feelings is that when you are with somebody in that moment, when they pass from life to death, to me, it's very natural to experience that as a journey, as a passage. You know, it's a you feel it, like you feel it in your body, you know, and I'm not a particularly woo-woo person, despite my fondness for my tarot card reader, but you feel it. You know, having sat with several people when they died, it seems to me if you are a moderately sensitive person, I mean, even like physically sensitive, you feel it. You feel the passage.
Yeah, I guess now that you say that, it's certainly not something that I thought to say before it happened. It's just something that felt...
You just feel it in the moment.
It's just something I said.
Yeah.
Has the way you've thought of death changed as a result of this loss or other losses?
Well, I mean, I'm not a big fan, but I do, I get it. It's, you know, it's like getting older. It's like falling in love. It's like falling out of love. It's like, it's just part of the kind of, you know, it's part of the canoe trip. It's just... I mean, I don't see it as a plus. On the other hand, I don't want to live to be like 140 years old or something like that, you know? Have people still explaining how to use my phone to me?
Yeah, I do. I do know. And do you feel like you've learned something from grief? Has grief changed you?
I think so. I actually think that... I think I'm probably a little kinder and more generous in my interpretations, and also just a little less judgy. But the less judgy has two sides to it. One is I don't care. It's like, you know, what's it to me what you are wearing or who you are marrying or how you, you know, like unless you're on the Supreme Court, you know, I don't have that much invested in what you think. But the superficial result of that is that I think I am probably nicer and more generous and less judgy. The other side of it, which is also related to loss and grief, is it's just more shit I don't care about.
Yeah, that makes sense. I would like to believe that I have acquired either of those characteristics, but I'm not sure that I have. I would like to think that it has changed me in some way for the better, but it's not clear to me.
I know. Also, I just want to say this because I really do think this is true. You got time. And my own experience is that the vines and the tendrils of grief and loss keep growing. And so it's not just where you are now. You're going to see that stuff flower in some other unexpected ways 10 years from now.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the image that puts in my own mind is like of myself as a tree with the grief growing at the bottom. And, you know, sometimes we'll grow at different rates.
You can't just judge it by the roots. You got to give the whole thing time.
Okay. I don't know. I feel like if you write about that metaphor in the future, you should at least give me like a footnote or.
100%. Mm-hmm. I mean, I won't use your real name, but, you know, I'll say a guy I spoke to.
Ah, that's worthless to me, honestly. Okay.
I agree.
Something else that you talked about that I think can be complicated for people to imagine is relief.
Oh,
like
sure.
After the pain, the, you know, and the, all the difficulty of life, there's also some relief when it's over. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I mean, I think we all feel like you're not supposed to have any of that. You know, it should just be somehow pure loss. And what I feel is that the relief is, in fact, part of the loss. And depending on your circumstances, there's a fair amount of anticipatory grieving. I mean, I was grieving the loss of Brian for 3 years. And I certainly didn't feel any relief quickly. Because he was struggling, but he was not in physical pain, which is also, you know, something I'm very grateful for. But, you know, sometimes I'm at home, especially sort of at the height of the pandemic came down upon me literally like 2 weeks after I got home from Zurich.
Wow.
You know, I mean, Brian died. I flew back. As I was flying back from Zurich, they were starting to close international airports. So, you know, I found myself thinking about there's a gentleman in my neighborhood, actually, who's an older man who has Alzheimer's, and I see him walking his dog. And I just thought, oh, what? He kept trying to keep Brian safe, and also he was having a lot of balance issues, and then, oh my God, I wouldn't be able to go to the ER with him? Like, how would he manage? I'd have to be out in the parking lot of an ER. I mean, the last couple of years, he was constantly, like, gashing a hand, skinning a knee, just, you know, minor things, some not so minor. And I do have a sense of relief that we didn't have to go through that, that I did not have to see him frantic with worry and discomfort in an ER that I couldn't be with him in. So that was a real little bit of a comfort, and it certainly was a certain kind of relief. Also, Brian had two close friends who had also played football with him, both of whom had early onset Alzheimer's. And I see what their families have gone through, because it's now 3, 5, 6 years later. And one of the widows came to me and she said, I just want to talk. And I was like, sure. And she said, I just want you to know that if we had been able to do what you and Brian did, we would have done it. We got the diagnosis so late because we were in so much denial that by the time we got the diagnosis, Dignitas was not an option for us. But I wish we had done that. And that was a tremendous gift to me.
I guess I'm assuming here, but I would imagine that some of Brian's thought process into the way he decided to die would have something to do with sparing you and himself.
I think so. I absolutely think so. I mean, I think, as Brian used to say, for better or worse, you know, it's a pyramid of relationships and concerns, but that his view was that he was at the top of his own pyramid, which was probably true, which was often a good thing, not always. But that he saw what it did to families. I mean, we saw what it did to these friends of ours who were couples. And he said, I want, really something I really loved about him. He said, I want people to miss me. I want them to be relieved. He said, I want people to be sad. I want them to be like, what a great guy. Not like, oh, yeah, years ago he was a great guy, but now he's, I mean, this is what Brian would have said. He didn't want it.
I have no experience with Alzheimer's, but part of what is I understand to be difficult is that, like your friend mentioned, that you can sort of be in denial about it.
You can.
Because it's not exactly, like the way I imagine it, and this may be totally inapt, is that it's like there's like a Arctic shelf that just collapses, but you may only see, oh, the water level has risen a quarter of an inch. It takes a while to notice that it's something catastrophic.
Or it's like chips in a cup, you know. If you have a mug, you can have a chip in it. You can still drink out of it. You can still have your coffee in it, even if it has a couple of chips. So only that point where it cracks and it can't hold the beverage anymore, then you go, oh, I see. Well, right up until that moment, scotch tape, ignore it, drink from the other side. You know, people make a lot of accommodations. And especially, I will say, if a person is fairly smart, it takes a little while longer because they have such ingrained social responses and conversational responses and remarks that they make that are sort of suitable for a wide range of conversations. And so you may not see that the foundation is slipping away because there's still something that kind of looks like a sandcastle. You know, it's still there.
Right. I mean, do you feel like the two of you were relatively quick to know what was happening?
Well, I had certainly perceived sort of symptoms and signs over the last 3 years before his diagnosis. I was very grateful that it was Brian himself who was like, we should go to a neurologist. There's something wrong with my short-term memory. I was not shocked by the diagnosis. I think Brian had thought, well, surely there's something that can be done. But I had researched this subject a lot more than he had. And I knew that there was really virtually nothing that could be done. It's also a very odd situation when you're in a doctor's office. It's like, you don't have that many conversations with the doctor in which they're like, so you can definitely join a clinical trial. And if they ever have medication that is proven to be helpful, you could be really first in line. And you're like, oh, is that soon? And they're like, no, none of this is soon. So for Brian, it was quite clear. He had seen Alzheimer's close up in his family, and he had seen it in his friends. And really, after sort of a weekend of crying our eyes out, he absolutely knew what he wanted to do. And there was never any question. There was never any wavering. It was 100% in keeping with his personality, which, as he would have said, is, you know, rather, I'd rather live as who I am, you know. I would rather die on my feet than live on my knees.
And that clarity is, the clarity of that sort of mission at that moment is amazing to me.
It was amazing to me too. But he had thought about these issues. He was interested in them. He was interested in issues of autonomy and agency and human rights and civil rights. And his feeling always was, this is my life. And it is a sort of funny thing, you know, in America, we are so big on individual rights and kind of the Wild West and the cowboy, except when it comes to things like this, in which case we don't want anybody to have the right to make their own decision in their own way.
Yeah, I guess I hadn't thought about it in that way before. I have two more questions for you, and then thank you for being so generous with your time. Do you think of Brian as being somewhere now?
Well, I sort of think of him as being, I'm sort of making a big fluffy hand gesture, sort of out there somewhere in some way, but not really embodied. So I call my tarot card reader, who's such a sensible and lovely person, and I go, so Susie, Brian was a big fly fisherman. I go, so is he like a salmon or something now? And Susie says to me in the flattest, most please pull yourself together kind of voice, she goes, that's not a thing. So I don't see him as a salmon. I guess my own feeling about it, it's not really a belief, it's like, oh, you know, those molecules must sort of sprinkle out in some way in the wide world. And I also tend to believe that, you know, if you love somebody and they're in your heart, that's pretty much what you get. I have no wish to argue with people about heaven and the afterlife. Whatever it is that people believe is absolutely fine with me. For myself, I'm not so much a sit around on the clouds, although that seems great, kind of person.
Yeah, right. Sounds amazing.
Sounds amazing. Absolutely. My mother was the nicest and most polite atheist I ever met in my life. And when people would talk about God and God's will and God's help, she would always say, oh, that sounds lovely. You know, as if there was like a sale on babka at the bakery. She just wasn't able to get there.
I love that. I feel like the polite atheist is almost like, that's almost a combination of words you never hear. I think of atheism as so strident in general. That's just really
no,
nice.
No, she was the soul of graciousness about it. And so I, you know, I try to keep that spirit with me. I mean, I'm not as good at it as she was, because I do have a certain amount of eye rolling in me. But my mother could really just be like, how nice for you.
So that's great. And then the only other question is there anything about this that you, I guess it's two questions. Is there anything about this that you wish I had asked you, or that you want to talk about that I haven't said?
No and no.
Okay, well, wonderful. This was A Good Cry with Amy Bloom. Thanks for listening. I hope it helps.
A Good Cry is brought to you by Radio Point and HeadGum, with executive producers Alex Bach, I'm talking Sabrina Fonfetter, and Daniel Powell. Of course, Richard Corson, and don't you forget Houston Snyder. It is also produced by the Abigail Lowenthal and mixed and edited by the one and only Ian Sorrentino.